Welcome to Episode 6 in a series of podcasts by Progressive United Methodists. Proclaiming the Whole Gospel, a gathering for Progressive United Methodists, took place on January 13th and 14th, 2006, at Campbell United Methodist Church in Campbell, California. This time, we hear from Mike Farrell of Hollywood, California. In addition to acting, best known as Captain B.J. Honeycutt on TV's MASH, directing, producing, and writing, Mr. Farrell has been a longtime champion of human rights throughout the world. He served as co-chair of Human Rights Watch in California from 1994 to 2004 and remains a member of the committee. He also serves as president of Death Penalty Focus and is member of the advisory board of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
We all enjoyed a particular TV show, I'm sure many of you did as well, called MASH. And at that time when we were in college, there was a war going on, a different war than today. That TV show was about a war in Korea, but we kind of all felt it was about something else. And those actors, we felt like they were with us in our objections to that war. Fast forward several decades, I have a son who's in high school. He recently did a paper on the death penalty and on the case of Stanley Tookie Williams. And one of the places that he went to do research was Mike Farrell's website at Death Penalty Focus. And once again, we felt that he was with us. So I just want to say how pleased we are that you are with us here today, and let us all welcome Mike Farrell.
Thank you very much for the gracious welcome. I remember that television series as well. And I had a hell of a good time, both watching it and playing it. I don't have such a good time with the other issue that was brought up, but I think it's an important one to discuss. And I'm very appreciative of your willingness to be here today, and of the invitation of Don Fado to speak to you about it. Let me ask you to imagine that you lived in a country that provided an example of human possibility for the rest of the world. Imagine that the fundamental premises of this country praise the inherent beauty, value, and dignity of every individual human being. Imagine that the promise of this country inspired hope in the breasts of men and women everywhere to reach upward for something higher and better than anything they'd ever known. Imagine the future that an opportunity such as this land embodied could create in the hearts and minds of hopeful beings. Imagine what could be created out of such a land if nurtured and further inspired by courageous, intelligent, compassionate, and hopeful leadership whose view was ever upward, ever outward. Imagine then this shining star, this limitless opportunity, shunted onto a siding, power wasting, vision fogging, hope diminishing, dreams dying, because of the rot of smugness, arrogance, greed, weakness, because of an absence of empowering spirit. Imagine the cancer of leaders without inspiration, of power-mad, self-satisfied, possibility-denying rulers who, lost in the excrement of their own frustrations, lack the power of curiosity and the courage of love, choosing instead to bludgeon hope with the mace of fear. Imagine then the sense of loss, the frustration, the enormous pit of despair that could encompass those who had once known possibility. Imagine the great tide of hopelessness that would appear, the cynicism that would follow, and the negligence that would result. I ask you to imagine this because it's the worm's eye view, held by some who don't enjoy the security in their lives that so many of us have come to rely on. They represent the bottom line, where a principled life separates itself from a constipated, fear-driven worldview. It's the line one steps across when choosing to expose the lie that suggests that some human beings are immaterial, inconsequential, invisible. I often find great truths told quite simply in available fiction. In Crusader's Cross, James Lee Burke tells us, a jail is not a geographical place. A jail is a condition. It rings with the sounds of steel clanging against steel, people yelling down stone corridors, toilets flushing, a screw losing it after an inmate throws feces through the bars into his face. The external world and the inside of a can, state, federal, city, county, or parish, do not have connection points based on reason, humanity, psychiatry, or penology. Jails represent human and societal failure at its worst, nothing more, nothing less. Jails are a shortstop way of separating undesirable people from the rest of us and rendering them as invisible as possible. Anyone who believes otherwise has never been there. The people who believe jails rehabilitate usually need jobs. Another book used as its primary character a cop who says very simply, everybody counts or nobody counts. And in a book called Harmful Intent, a man by the name of Bain Kerr made a very wise observation. He said, in cynical times, right and wrong can be hard to sort out. Goodness and truth can seem beyond our reach. But we have the option, the obligation, to put cynicism aside and exercise the public virtues. To find truth, oppose wrong, protect innocence, promote good, and do right. Well, in support of that obligation, I hope you'll bear with me this morning as I lead to a particular issue that speaks volumes about who we are as a people and where we're going as a nation. Joe Giratano was on Virginia's death row for 12 years before being commuted to life because of possible innocence. I was involved in that case and remain so, as Joe is still in prison for a crime the evidence says he didn't commit. In a letter from Virginia, the Virginia Supermax, where he has been for many years, Joe wrote last year, life comes at us the way it comes, and it cannot be otherwise. As I reflect, he says, I come to recognize that we human beings possess something which is at once more terrible and wonderful than all else, the ability to make ourselves and our world better or worse. I sense that humanity as a whole may not have progressed, nor will it meaningfully advance, if not for human beings who resolutely and passionately champion a cause they believe in. So many, he says, I've been fortunate enough to encounter during the course of my odyssey, epitomized for me the fundamental fact that only by communicating one's realization with passion can the truth, one way or another, break through the fog of complacency that lays thick upon our consciousness as a species. I suppose, he says, that's one of our chief duties, to speak out to the best of our ability, maybe quietly and gently, maybe with angry wisdom, maybe with slow and careful analysis, maybe by unshakable public example. But speak out we must if humanity is to remain alive and awake. To abstain in stoical or ironical detachment, or to stay dithered in the middle ground, is to atrophy. The middle ground won't get us where we want to go. I was once at an event in the inner city of Los Angeles for a group of attorneys who work with the people there representing those who live in deplorable conditions, helping them to assert their rights against exploitive slumlords. A quote from one of the young children they had helped was on a banner in the back of the room. Mommy, it said, does this mean we don't have to live in the rat house anymore? That's a fairly simple, easily understandable message. No one, least of all a child, should have to live among rats. But I asked those folks to consider another child as well, not this one who tugs at our heartstrings, but a child from the same set of circumstances who feels the need for what he perceives as justice and says instead, Mommy, I'm going to find the people who made you feel like this and make them sorry. What happens to that child? Maybe, She leaves her rat-infested home and finds her way to a place of hope. Or maybe, if he's already in a place that promises hope, but has been robbed of it, he steps across the line and becomes an outlaw, striking out at those in society who, in his mind, have done him and his mother harm. Clearly, there's enough information around us today to demonstrate that we are failing many of those in our society by deeming them invisible. If Hurricane Katrina did nothing else, it laid bare that fact. We compound that failure, then, by forcing them into a system, a school system, a legal system, a criminal justice system, a medical system, a welfare system, in which invisible people suffer invisibly, and then if they misbehave, we destroy them. Unless someone cares enough to pierce the shield of invisibility, the children from rat-infested places, the invisible people whose hearts yearn for justice, implode and do harm to themselves, or explode and do harm in another way. And when they do, there are those quick to disavow their humanity, name them monsters, animals, evildoers, and insist that they deserve the most brutal of consequences. An insult to our very existence, they do not deserve to live. They must die so that we don't have to think too long or too hard about what separates them from us. The method we've chosen to destroy these unacceptable monsters is one we've attempted to sterilize, to sanctify in a way, by declaring its necessity and providing its ceremony. We call it capital punishment. A difficult subject, capital punishment. Most people have a feeling about it, but don't really want to talk about it at length. They usually don't want to think about the fact that when we discuss state killing, we're actually talking about a much larger question. The question of whether the death penalty is right or wrong is actually a question about who we are as a people and what kind of society we choose to live in. What do we stand for? And what do we aspire to? So with that as a preamble, let me ask you to look at this issue. State killing is not often discussed rationally. It's too rarely discussed at all. It's a tough subject and frightens and confuses a lot of people. It hides behind slogans, posturing, ambition, and politics. As there's probably not time now to examine it thoroughly, I'd like to give you an overview and perhaps later, if we have the opportunity, respond to some questions. If you believe the polls, support for capital punishment has dropped precipitously in the past few years. More in-depth polls even add the option of life without parole and often show support for capital punishment falling below a majority. That fact doesn't usually make the news, nor is it likely to be acknowledged by so-called leaders who continue to insist that they support state killing only because the people demand it. Many Americans don't believe life in prison without the possibility of parole actually exists. They think life sentences are a kind of turnstile operation where bloodthirsty killers are sentenced to prison for life only to be turned back out again a few years later to do their dirty work again. Not comfortable with that idea and believing that there's no effective alternative, people make what they deem the safer choice, to kill. But this choice becomes state and national policy. Of course, it's easier to just leave it up to the experts and go about our business. But looking at it over the last 30 years, one finds that we're not really leaving it up to the experts. We're leaving it up to the politicians. Over the past three decades, political jargon, slick packaging, sales techniques, and clever use of the electronic media have distanced us from an awareness of the harm we do by continuing an outdated and, I believe, quite immoral practice, discontinued in every advanced Western nation except our own, practice of putting our citizens to death. Now, I was taught that killing is wrong. If so, it's at least as wrong for the state to kill in cold blood as it is for an individual to do so in heat. At least as wrong because society has an obligation to hold itself to a higher standard, to remember that it acts for all, not only for all, but also is the model of appropriate behavior for its younger members. That being so, the cold, dehumanizing, ritualistic killing of those we deem unacceptable teaches that the taking of a human life is permissible if one is in a position of power and is acting in furtherance of a cause believed to be just, a lesson that's been too well learned to judge by what takes place in our streets today. Dr. James Gilligan, in his book, Violence, Our Deadly Epidemic and Its Causes, says, all violence is an attempt to achieve justice, or what the violent person perceives as justice. Thus, the attempt to achieve and maintain justice, or to undo or prevent injustice, is the one and only universal cause of violence. Now, I realize that many people, perhaps some in this room, believe that in good conscience it's appropriate under certain circumstances for the state to take a life. While I disagree, except in the obvious case of national or personal self-defense, I certainly respect one's right to come to that conclusion. I don't mean to suggest that my morality is somehow higher or more holy than that person's. But rather, I ask only that that person examine the issue not on an abstract or philosophical plane, but instead look carefully at what a death penalty system truly means in a society such as ours, what it does, who it impacts, who it serves, and what our moral obligation is with regard to the mistakes it makes. And as is the case with any institution designed and maintained by human beings, it does make mistakes. So, to those of you, or to those whom you know, who believe that state killing is necessary and just and or appropriate under certain circumstances, please consider, or ask them to consider, these points. First, understand that we kill the innocent. A death system designed and operated by human beings will make mistakes. I put that in the future tense only because that's the position of the more dedicated supporters of capital punishment, such as Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Kaczynski says that if we continue on our current path, innocents will surely die. He adds, we have constructed a machine that is extremely expensive, chokes our legal institutions, visits repeated trauma on victims' families, and ultimately produces nothing like the benefits we could expect from an effective system of capital punishment. This, he says, is surely the worst of all possible worlds, a self-defeating tactic which will do nothing to ensure that the very worst members of our society are put to death. Kaczynski calls for changes that will ensure that only the most heinous criminals, the worst of the very bad, be put to death. Now, by the same logic, the late Justice Harry Blackmun of the U.S. Supreme Court came to a different conclusion. The death penalty remains, he said, fraught with arbitrariness, discrimination, caprice, and mistake. From this day forward, he said, I shall no longer tinker with the machinery of death. For more than 20 years, I've endeavored, indeed I have struggled, along with a majority of the court, to develop procedural and substantive rules that would lend more than the appearance of fairness to the death penalty endeavor, rather than coddle the court's delusion that the desired level of fairness has been achieved. I feel morally and intellectually obligated to concede that the death penalty experiment has failed. The problem, he said, is that the inevitability of factual, legal, and moral error gives us a system that we know must wrongly kill some defendants. Now, refuting both justices' suggestion that it hasn't happened yet, a study by Radelet, Badeau, and Putnam in their book Executing the Innocent says that up until 1992, 435 innocent people were convicted of capital crimes in this country. Some were exonerated and freed. Some died in prison. Some had their sentences reduced. 26 were executed. Since that study was completed, more innocent have died. In a speech a couple of years ago, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor expressed concern about the release of innocents from death row and the likelihood of some being wrongly executed. She may have forgotten that Leonel Herrera was executed in Texas in 1995 after the Supreme Court refused to hear new evidence of actual innocence. In that case, Justice Antonin Scalia argued that innocence was not a constitutionally defensible principle on appeal. Justice Blackmun, in dissent, called the court's decision perilously close to simple murder. And if you were listening, you may have heard the Justice Presumptive Alito the other day refusing to answer Senator Feingold's question about that very issue. Jesse Jacobs was killed after Leonel Herrera in Texas. Despite the admission of the district attorney who prosecuted him that another did the murder. Jesse Tefero, whose head was set afire as he died in Florida's electric chair, was unable to benefit from evidence presented 2 years later that destroyed the state's case and freed his co-defendant. You may have heard of Gary Graham, also known as Shaka Sankofa in Texas, who was killed by then-Governor Bush without ever having all the exonerating evidence heard in court. State of Georgia recently apologized to the family of Lena Baker, a woman executed 50 years ago who has now been proven innocent. Today, Missouri is reinvestigating the 1995 execution of Larry Griffin because of new evidence pointing to his innocence. And it's recently been discovered that Reuben Cantu, a 17-year-old gangbanger from Texas who was tried, convicted, and executed in 1993, did not commit the crime for which he died. The forewoman of the jury responsible for his death said, "The bottom line is an innocent person was put to death, and we all have our finger in that." The district attorney who prosecuted him has since forsworn the use of capital punishment. In 1998, my organization, Death Penalty Focus, co-sponsored a conference at Northwestern University's Law School that presented 30 of the then 78 men and women who had been tried, convicted, and sentenced to death since the reinstatement of capital punishment in 1976, many of whom had spent years on death row, some coming within hours of execution, only to be finally completely exonerated and freed. It was a profoundly moving and very difficult experience, as you can imagine. And the shock to the system that that conference provided, augmented by the development of more sophisticated DNA analyses, has resulted in a virtual avalanche of exonerations to the point that today, a few short years later, the number of those freed from death row has climbed to 122. Now, how do we give these people back their lives? Some of you are aware of a film called After Innocence that is now just being released, and I urge you to see it if you haven't, because it addresses this very question. Kirk Bloodsworth, a former Marine who spent 9 years on death row in Maryland for the rape and murder of a young girl before finally being cleared by a DNA test, said of attempts to put it behind him and start a new life, "It never ends. It never, ever ends. It never ends. It never will be ended." Every time he goes somewhere and applies for a job, anytime he goes somewhere and meets someone, he is the man who was sentenced to death for committing the rape and murder of a child. Worse, after Governor George Ryan emptied Illinois' death row, the Chicago Tribune reviewed 88 different cases in which 97 death row prisoners were set free. Each release, some would have you believe, suggests that the justice system has corrected itself. But the court records indicate that an alternate suspect was identified in dozens of those cases, while police charged a new suspect in just 10 of them. This reflects what I think of as an institutional imperative against admitting error. The reluctance of authorities or institutions to admit error and seek new suspects, preferring, as many do today, to continue to maintain that the freed individual is in fact the guilty one, allowing the actual perpetrator to remain free to do his will. In 2004, Cameron Willingham was executed in Texas for an arson that killed his three children. He steadfastly maintained his innocence. This year, Ernest Willis was freed from death row after the arson investigation that led to his conviction was discredited. Both convictions were based upon the theory that accelerants were used, indicating that the fires had been intentionally set. Both convictions were based on speculative interpretations of something called crazed glass that was found at the crime scene. The splintered glass was originally believed to be caused by an accelerant spray. However, what they call crazed glass also occurs when cold water is used to put out a fire and hits hot glass. The deputy state fire marshal, Manuel Vasquez, testified to similar conclusions in both cases. The convictions were only 5 years apart, Willingham in 1987, Willis in 1992. Both were appealed to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Both were denied. In both cases, reinvestigations of the evidence by fire expert Gerald Hurst stated that the burn patterns and residue were consistent with flashover, a phenomenon unique to electrical fires rather than arson. According to the Chicago Tribune, the cases were nearly identical. Then Texas Deputy Fire Marshal Edward Cheever has admitted that in the Willingham case, as he put it, we were still testifying to things that aren't accurate today. They were true then, but they aren't now. We know now not to make those same assumptions. We know now that Cameron Willingham is dead at the hands of the state of Texas. Point number two, please understand that racism taints our criminal justice system and has totally corrupted the machinery of death. This has not only been borne out by every study done privately and was recently found to be true in a new study of California's system, but was carefully delineated by the United States Congress. The Racial Justice Act, legislation intended to remedy the problem, was defeated in Congress, largely because it was feared that an unintended side effect would be to effectively put an end to the death system in this country. Former Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell cast the deciding vote and wrote for the majority in the infamous McCleskey case in 1987, which held that although the racial studies then presented demonstrated a significant bias against black people in our criminal justice system, McCleskey still had to die because he hadn't proven bias in his particular case. In the majority opinion against McCleskey, Powell admitted that the findings presented, if upheld by the court, would undermine the entire criminal justice system in our country. After his retirement, Powell said that upon reflection, out of his entire career, the one vote he wished he could change was McCleskey. I was part of an unsuccessful campaign to get President Clinton in the last days of his administration to declare a moratorium on federal executions in the face of the then fast approaching dates of men awaiting death in federal prison. What he did instead was give us half a loaf by staying the execution of the first man for 6 months and thus punting to the current administration. Our appeal was based on the Justice Department's own study showing racial, ethnic, and geographic bias in the charging of death penalty cases in the federal system. The report showed that of the 675 cases where U.S. attorneys recommended death sentences, only slightly more than one quarter were white defendants. Blacks comprised almost half of those defendants recommended for death, and Hispanics about one-fifth. Today, in the federal system, roughly 81% of men on the federal death row are members of minority groups. Point number three, please understand that only the poor are executed. Or as the prison slogan has it, them that has the capital don't get the punishment. A study of capital trials in America will demonstrate that prosecutors rarely go for death against a wealthy defendant. Unsuccessful prosecutions, often the result of going up against a high-priced defense attorney, don't look good on their records. Pope John Paul II called for Catholics to be mindful of a special option for the poor. Criminal justice in America has made the death penalty the exclusive option of the poor. The 3,400 men and women, 3,400 plus, men and women on America's death rows today are virtually all poor people, a significant percentage of whom, had they been able to afford a good, competent defense attorney, would not be where they are today. Between 40 and 50% of capital convictions have been reversed in the years since the death penalty was reinstated, found unconstitutional in 1972 because of arbitrary and capricious use. It was reinstated in 76 after certain safeguards were put into place. A large percentage of the reversals are granted on the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel. Those who study this issue maintain that the people who end up on death row today are not those who are the most guilty, but rather those who had the worst lawyers. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, speaking at the University of the District of Columbia, said, "I have yet to see a death case among the dozens coming to the Supreme Court on eve of execution stay applications in which the defendant was well represented at trial." People, she said, who are well represented at trial do not get the death penalty. Court-appointed counsel in death cases provided by law for indigent defendants is all too often either inexperienced, incompetent, or so overworked, as is the case with public defenders, that the ideal of equal justice is made a mockery. In many states, court-appointed counsel are paid a statutorily limited amount of money. Asking lawyers to take cases that are unpopular, hugely time-consuming, and emotionally difficult, then paying the equivalent of about $10 per hour doesn't promise good results. Some of you may have heard of Calvin Burdine of Texas, Mr. Burdine was represented by an attorney who slept during significant portions of the trial. He would point this out to the judge. The judge would ask the bailiff to awaken the lawyer. The lawyer would be awakened for a period of time and then go back to sleep. As one judge reviewing the case put it, said, the Constitution says you have to have an attorney. It doesn't say he has to be awake. Texas Court of Criminal Appeals last year ruled that a man whose attorney slept through portions of his 1992 death penalty trial should not get a new trial because he had another, if less experienced, attorney who remained awake. In its ruling, the court denied George McFarland's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel and upheld his death sentence. We conclude, they said, that although one of his attorneys slept through portions of his trial, applicant was not deprived of the assistance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment because his second attorney was present and an active advocate at all times. That second attorney had little experience and disagrees with the ruling, saying his inexperience provided little help for Mr. McFarland. And the prosecutors they come up against. In Ohio, in March of 1997, one prosecutor was unfazed when fresh exculpatory evidence was presented to the court, exculpatory meaning evidence that pointed to innocence. The state did not dispute the accuracy of this new evidence, but the prosecutor, Dan Gershutz, said, even though this new evidence may establish Mr. Ritchie's innocence, the Ohio and United States Constitution nevertheless allows him to be executed because the prosecution did not know that the scientific testimony offered at the trial was false and unreliable. A former assistant district attorney in Philadelphia was caught on tape teaching new prosecutors to strike black jurors because they were thought to be pro-defense. In California, a former prosecutor testified last year that he had been told by a judge to strike Jews from juries because they'll never vote for a death sentence. Point number four, please understand that the death penalty costs more than twice as much as life without parole. Excuse me. First, a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole does exist and is available in most states. It is used here. In California, according to the governor's office, over 3,100 people have been given life without parole, or LWOP as it's known in the trades. And the only three ever released were because it was found they were innocent. One of them, Dwayne McKinney, spent 19 years behind bars before that happy development occurred. Another, Tom Goldstein, was there for 24 years, both innocent. In Texas, the nation's leading killer of convicted felons, has only recently adopted an LWOP alternative. The storm of attention and controversy surrounding the executions of Carla Faye Tucker, Gary Graham, and others, as well as the recent discovery of corruption in their forensic labs, finally made it happen, though it was fought viciously by the state's prosecutors, who felt, you should know, that not having the alternative of life without parole to offer juries meant that they could tell the jurors that if they didn't kill the individual on trial, there was the possibility he would one day get out and terrorize them again. Because of the Supreme Court mandated safeguards mentioned earlier, those changes intended to deal with the problems inherent in the death penalty, certain legal requirements have to be met in order to meet constitutional muster. The court has held that death is different, so extra care must be taken to avoid error. One is a bifurcated trial, which is essentially two trials, one to determine guilt or innocence, and the second, if a guilty verdict is come to determine the sentence. A jury in a capital case must be death qualified, screened in order to weed out anyone who opposes the death penalty on principle, a notion rife with ethical problems of its own. As a recent study showed, that those who support the death penalty are more likely to be both racially prejudiced and more pro-prosecution. This has resulted in a ruling in Florida that ministers, preachers thought too likely to be sympathetic, can be excused from juries for no other reason than the presumption of sympathy. Extra security measures are required in capital cases. Extra provision must be made in many states for investigation, background checks, psychological studies, researching for mitigating circumstances, etc. And then there are a series of court-mandated appeals to ensure that the process was fair and the defendant's constitutional rights were honored. These appeals go first through the state process and then the federal. It takes years to go through this process, not because of tricks or delaying tactics on the part of the defense, but because the Supreme Court has said that the taking of a life requires such care. In this process, 40 to 50% of death cases fall out, resulting in either a new trial or a lesser sentence. And even with all these precautions, we find people spending 10, 15, 20 years on death row before being exonerated through the use of a new scientific technique or the diligent work of a caring lawyer or friend, or in a couple of famous cases, students, or simply an interested party. Now, all of this takes time and costs money. We now know that a death penalty trial, appeals, and eventual execution costs 2 to 3 times as much as does a simple trial for life without parole and the maintenance in prison of the convicted person for an average of 40 years. The Sacramento Bee did a study in the early 90s that showed California would save about $90 million per year through the simple expedient of eliminating the death system. An interesting consideration today as we face a multi-billion dollar budget shortfall. Actually, the attorney at the time, he is an attorney today, but he was working for State Senator John Briggs, a name some of you may remember, in the 70s, and wrote what is now our death penalty law here in California. He has come to the conclusion the death penalty cannot be implemented fairly and has come out against it. He told me yesterday that the new cost of operating the death system in California is $200 million per year. Point number 5. Please understand that we are killing the mentally damaged and until recently the mentally retarded in our chambers of death. Though a growing number of states placed explicit legal bars against executing the mentally retarded, others, including the state of California, refused. Thus, it was up to the Supreme Court in the summer of 2002 to reverse its own 12-year-old finding and outlaw the execution of the mentally retarded. But retardation is, in too many instances, like the question of sanity, with different experts arguing different conclusions. Because of hair-splitting decisions and the need to feed the machine, prosecutors find themselves in the unenviable position of accusing sick, deranged, disturbed, and retarded people of faking their conditions. In Marin County, California argued that convicted murderer Horace Kelly, who has been living in his own excrement for over 2 decades, surrounded by moldy food and soiled bedding, in a state of bizarre delusions and hallucinations, incoherence, catatonic behavior, and inappropriate affect, this according to a prison psychiatrist, is sane enough for us to kill. In Arkansas, in 1992, Ricky Ray Rector, who had effectively been lobotomized by a self-inflicted gunshot wound at the time of his crime and had virtually no comprehension of his situation, was led to his execution so that then Governor Clinton, who wanted to be president, could appear tough on crime. As was his habit, Rector left the dessert from his last meal waiting in his cell for, as he put it, when he returned. In April of 1999, Manny Babbitt died here in California for killing an elderly woman. A slow boy, Manny, still in the 7th grade at the age of 17, quit school and became a Marine, where they lowered the standards to let him in. There he served at the siege of Khe Sanh in Vietnam. He came back from there even more different than before, living on the street, obsessing about the war, drinking, using drugs, lost. Ultimately diagnosed as schizophrenic, Manny was turned back out on the streets. The circumstance at the crime scene led many to believe he was suffering a delayed stress-induced flashback at the time of the murder. For example, he left the body tagged, toe-tagged, a practice used for dead Marines at Khe Sanh. Manny had no memory of the crime, but then Governor Davis had no mercy. Wanda Jean Allen was killed in Oklahoma 4 years ago, a woman with brain damage and an IQ of 69. Johnny Paul Penry in Texas had his conviction overturned by the United States Supreme Court and is still struggling with the state who wants to kill him. When given word that the Supreme Court had stayed his execution the last time around, Penry said, and I quote, "The only thing I know is the warden come back and told me, 'Mr. Penry, you got to stay.'" From his lawyers, Penry had come to understand that the word stay meant that he would not be put to death that night. He said that the warden, who was accompanied by a chaplain, held a legal document, and Penry's words were, he couldn't read it to me, so he'd give it to Father Walsh to read. The warden didn't understand the Catholic language, and it was in Catholic. Father Walsh read it to me because he understands Catholic. In 2003, the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit approved the involuntary administration of antipsychotic drugs to a death row inmate so he could be made sane enough to be executed. In 2004, Human Rights Watch said that 1 in 6 of those in our prisons today are mentally ill, creating a phenomenon in which the United States enjoys the distinction of having more of its mentally ill population in prison than in mental institutions. Point number 6, the times they are a-changing. Until last year, we killed those who were children when they committed their crimes, despite international agreements condemning it. That practice put us in the company of Nigeria, Afghanistan, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. One study showed that the majority of young people examined on death row, those who were legally children when they committed the crimes for which they stood convicted, presented visible brain damage as a result of head trauma. Sean Sellers was executed in Oklahoma for killing his parents when he was 16 years old. This is a boy who had been diagnosed as having multiple personality syndrome, usually a result of extreme physical and sexual abuse as a child. The diagnosis was recognized by an appeals court that felt itself barred from intervening in the execution because the issue had not been properly raised at trial. In October of 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to halt the execution of two men who were sentenced to death for crimes committed when they were juveniles. In an unusually strong dissent, 4 members of the court called such executions shameful and added, "The practice of executing such offenders is a relic of the past and is inconsistent with evolving standards of decency in a civilized society." They were, as you might expect, Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. That was subsequently repeated by the Missouri Supreme Court, which held the execution of a juvenile offender to be unconstitutional, and that case, on challenge, was subsequently sent to the Supreme Court. Last March, in the case Roper v. Simmons, the United States Supreme Court brought us kicking and screaming into the 21st century by outlawing the execution of those who were juveniles when they committed capital crimes. It should be noted that the dissenting voices were rather bitter. Point number 7, and my last point, what are the victims? Don't they deserve closure? As one who has lost a beloved friend to violence, the concept of closure is, in my view, a creature of prosecutors and some so-called victims' rights groups who preach that the only way our pain can be ended is to inflict it on another family by spilling the blood of their loved one. The existence of Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation, a nationwide group of families of murder victims, argues otherwise. Their view is perhaps best summed up by Tom Mauser, a former supporter of the death penalty, who lost a son in the shootings at Columbine High School. Mr. Mauser said, "I've come to learn that even with the death of my son's killer, even with the pressure of those in society who rush us to reach closure, there is no closure when you lose a child. I believe," he said, "that a death sentence is merely an attempt to gain revenge, not closure. I believe that a barbaric, violent act of revenge is not a way to honor our loved one." Fyodor Dostoevsky said, "If you want to look into the soul of a nation, look into its prisons." Less well known is that then Home Secretary Winston Churchill, in his 1910 address to Parliament, said, "The mood and temper of the public in regard to the treatment of crime and criminals is one of the most unfailing tests of the civilization of any country. A calm, dispassionate recognition of the rights of the accused and even of the convicted criminal measures the stored up strength of a nation and is sign and proof of the living virtue in it." Nelson Mandela, who has reason to know, said a nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but its lowest ones. Virtually all major faith groups oppose the use of capital punishment because it is applied in a manner that is racially disproportionate, because it kills the innocent, the mentally ill, the economically disadvantaged, because it has skewed the political system by attacks on judges unfairly characterized as soft on crime, because it has been used to create a political climate which puts undue pressure on police and prosecutors to perform, thus increasing the likelihood of police and prosecutorial misconduct, because it is used by slogan-wielding demagogues who have found that tough-on-crime rhetoric helps a political career, because it is unnecessary, ineffective, and destructive of the moral fabric of our nation, I believe we must put an end to this loathsome practice. And to emphasize the loathsome nature of this practice, let me remind you that in approximately 60 hours, we Californians will put to death a 76-year-old man who is legally blind, deaf, and wheelchair-bound. The idea that Governor Schwarzenegger and his minions believe that the shameful spectacle of extracting their pound of flesh before this helpless man can die of natural causes resembles justice, civilization, or humanity makes me want to vomit. I hope you'll consider joining me and the organization I chair, Death Penalty Focus. Help us end this madness. Help us remind Americans who we are and what our nation can be. Thank you for your attention.
This concludes podcast number 6 from Proclaiming the Whole Gospel, a gathering for Progressive United Methodists held in January 2006. For more podcasts in this series, visit http://progressiveunitedmethodists.blogspot.com. If you have comments about this podcast, please send them to progressiveunitedmethodists@gmail.com.